This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Place to Be Nation, welcome to another rousing edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. We are finally beginning to get out of the malaise that has gripped us for 2 weeks now. Yes, we are still in a post-Ho-Ho-Loon elimination from the WWE Cruiserweight Classic World, but we're in good spirits, we're ready, we're jumping around. The fog is lifting, and we're ready to bring you some power of positivity into the comic book world. I am Greg Phillips. Joining me, as always, my compatriot, my compadre, some consider him to be the greatest American, Nick Duke. Nick, how is you?
I'm doing well, I suppose. That was an overly enthusiastic introduction. What the hell's gotten the pep in your step?
Oh, quite frankly, I've been lifting weights and doing cocaine for hours. I am ready.
Oh, Scott Jorgensen, I love it.
Mr. Tarkanian, I am ready. In any event, it's been quite the week in the world of comic books and entertainment. A lot of stories out there. The Chris Brown things going on in the world to talk about. None of those will be talked about here, of course. You can go elsewhere to talk about those. We're not here to talk about raps or graps or anything like that. We're here to talk about comics. Namely, we're going to get cracking right off the bat with your favorite segment, Russell Sellers of Sellers Points Podcast, the one listener who enjoys this segment. With what you're reading and what you're watching.
How do we know that Russell is the only person who enjoys it?
I presume it.
How do we know that Russell enjoys it?
I don't. I presume it. I assume that at least he will pretend to enjoy it.
Well, at the very least, it'll be short this week.
That's right, because speak up if I'm speaking out of turn here. Neither of us have watched anything comic book related, other than what we're talking about here today, which... we haven't gotten to yet. This is, of course, our very first edition of the Hard Travelers for Hire.
Yes.
Yes.
I'm Hard Ron Travelers. Burgundy.
That's right. That indeed was the reference. Hard Travelers for Hire, right here on Place to Be Nation Pop, where we'll be taking a look at 2008's Jon Favreau-directed Iron Man. And
I'm stunned later. You didn't go for the Iron Man pull.
Not yet, Nick. That's for later on. Don't you worry about that. I got plans for that. But before we get there, reading and watching, we're not watching anything. Nothing's on of interest except Fear the Walking Dead, which I am waiting until it comes to Netflix to binge it. So I'm out of the Fear the Walking Dead business
for now. Hopelessly behind right now.
Hopelessly behind. Have you watched any of Supergirl and or whatever else you have to catch up on?
No.
Fair enough. Let's move on to what you're reading. Which, okay, let me explain, ladies and gentlemen. I, 1 week ago, said that I was going to purchase all of these comics I was behind on. And I did. I did. I went on Sunday to my local comic book shop, Fanatics, here in Dothan, Alabama. I walked in the door. I said, I would like to collect my pull list. I looked at it. I noticed one or two items that were not in there. And I said, let me go collect them from the shelves. I collected them from the shelves. I saw a few other books that caught my eye, one or two. And I said, you know what? I'm going to try this out too. And I grabbed it and I put it in my pull list. And I said, all right, ring me up. And they rung me up to the tune of over $80. And I promptly had a crisis. Not quite a midlife crisis, hopefully. Who am I kidding? Probably a midlife crisis. And went home and wept for hours. But I did have time to read a few comics, but not close to enough to get me prepared for this segment. So I am going to do our normal top three, bottom one, exclusively based on Detective Comics, which is all I've been reading to catch up on. As you know, I was remarkably behind. And I read, in the last week I've read, I think, three issues of Detective. Maybe four.
So you won't have a bottom one.
I won't have a bottom one.
This is to me, Greg talks about Detective Comics.
That's right. This is the Detective Comics Minute with Greg Phillips. Smooth jazz playing. The sultry sounds of my voice lulling you to sleep. I am talking to you about Detective Comics 936 through 938, all of which I've read in this past week, and all of which are very good. James Tynion the Fourth, is doing a wonderful job of writing a series. It continues, it maintains a vibe that seems a little bit like Batman the Animated Series, but almost a little bit more like Justice League Unlimited, perhaps. A very, very good team dynamic, a very good vibe to the way it plays out. The dynamics between the team members, particularly I enjoy Clayface, I have enjoyed Batwoman, and I am enjoying Tim Drake for the first time in a long time. So, big fan of this series thus far.
You scoffed last week when I said I wanted to read a little Tim Drake solo action as a result of this series.
I did scoff. And let me clarify my scoffage for a moment. You see, I never read much of Chuck Dixon's solo Robin book when I was younger. I based my Tim Drake, not dislike, but apathy for his rather bland and generic personality in the Batman books. And I say that with the caveat that the Red Robin series pre-New 52 was really good. I really enjoyed it. I think you know I was a big fan of that take on Tim where everybody thought he was crazy and maybe he was for thinking that Bruce was alive. I really enjoyed that. But this is the best Tim Drake has been written in a long, long time, since Fabian Nicieza was writing him. And big fan of what they're doing with all these characters. I thought 938 was excellent, probably the best issue of the series thus far that I've read. It's been building properly. I do have one concern that I think we discussed off air briefly, and it does involve a spoiler. I don't know if we want to talk about this, Nick. What do you think? You know what I'm talking about. We spoke about it earlier.
Oh, I think it's fine at this point.
I don't know how far behind I am either. The last issue I read was 938. What are they up to now?
That's a fantastic question to which I have no answer. What was the last thing that happened in 938?
The last thing that happened in 938, well, that would obviously clearly be
Greg stalling for enough time to open the book.
And at the end of the issue, you see the Ulysses Hadrian Armstrong character tell Colonel Kane about these new drones that he's developed that can't separate the targets from each other, basically. And Kane okays it, even though there will be civilian lives lost. This is after the team has come and broken Batman out of the cave that he was being held in by the evildoers.
Yes, that would actually be... So 939 would have come out since then, so you're still an issue behind.
Okay. Well, spoiler alert! The tease in Detective Comics, not really even so much a tease, they're outright saying it, although Batman doesn't believe it, but I'm certain it will end up being the case. Colonel Kane and his group of hench people are operating under the belief that there is a secret organization known as the League of Shadows, which, correct me if I'm wrong, Nick, the League of Shadows was a Batman the Animated Series creation? Is that correct?
I can't remember.
I know it was in the, I know they used that in the Nolan movies.
Yeah, it was that. Yeah, there was no League of Assassins in the Nolan movies. It was
the League of Shadows.
The League of Shadows. Yeah. So
right, and which
my understanding of it is in the past when it's been used, whether it was used on the animated series or not, it was just pretty much as a stand-in for the League.
A stand-in for League of Assassins when they didn't want to say assassins, right? Or in Nolan's case, it was because he wanted to play with the stealth aspects as opposed to the international assassin aspect.
Right.
So, anyway, the idea is that the League of Shadows exists and is separate from the League of Assassins, and that Ra's al Ghul has used this as a what Batman calls a myth to intimidate people, to make them think that there is this secret conspiracy that spans the globe and serves his bidding or what have you, and that he uses it as a fear tactic. Well, the government believes, this led by Colonel Kane, that the League of Shadows is real, and as you see in a file that is opened, that the Court of Owls is presumably part of the League of Shadows. So here's my problem, and that addressed actually part of my concern when I saw that page. But I have to say, everything that they've said about the League of Shadows so far, that it's been there the whole time right in front of them, and that Batman never knew it existed, and that that it was operating from the shadows and seemingly normal people were actually part of this conspiracy, it's exactly like the Court of Owls. Exactly like the Court of Owls. And, you know, it's if they reveal that the Court of Owls are part of it, okay, cool. But it's not the most creative thing in the world because it just was done just a couple years ago and done in a way that you're probably not going to be able to top. So I'm a little concerned about treading over old ground. Plus, I'm not nuts about the idea of the government knowing about something in Gotham that Batman doesn't know about, you know, being that he's been on the streets the whole time. But I'm going to let it play out because, like I said earlier, Detective has been an amazing book, one of the best books of Rebirth, in my opinion. I would easily put it in my top five, maybe even in my top three or four. It's been that good. I'm really enjoying it.
Well, and, you know, this story isn't really dealing with the League of Shadows directly, so I would say, you know, wait and let's see how they handle it before we determine how similar it is to the Court of Owls. In concept, I'll agree it sounds fairly similar, but in execution and in the group's ultimate purpose and how they go about handling their business, it could wind up being a vastly different thing altogether.
True. I wonder if they'll tie in other different secret organizations in addition to the Court of Owls that have dealt with Batman over the years, whether it be the League of Assassins, of course, which you would assume would be a separate wing or what have you, and also, of course, your favorite group and mine, the Black Glove.
Oh, yeah. Maybe we'll get a little Les Bossus.
As
the true mastermind behind it all.
That's right. And El Sombrero. The hat.
And the flamingo.
Yes, the flamingo. Anyway, that's the Detective Comics Much More Than a Minute with Greg Phillips. Nick, your top three, bottom one.
Nope, none of that this week because, being a fifth Wednesday, it was kind of a light release schedule, especially for DC. So I only actually had two books to pick up this week. So very quickly, those books were Spider-Man number 7, which was fantastic. It was a Civil War II tie-in. Actually did more to explain the thematic difference between the two sides than the main Civil War II series has done, in my opinion. Very much enjoyed this issue, even though it was largely dialogue-based. Brought up some interesting questions about Miles and his relationship with Tony, and if, stop me if you've heard this before, but is there a possibility that perhaps Tony is just using Miles for his own personal gain? So
I don't believe that.
Good stuff going on in Spider-Man number 7. And then, of course, Justice League of America number 9. This is the pre-rebirth Brian Hitch series that has been plagued by delays. Finally had a number 9 issue hit this past week. A very, very good issue. Even if it's been so long between issues that I've kind of forgotten all the plot threads that were left dangling in number 8. But all that being said, I was able to pick things up back up pretty quickly, and it seems to be setting up for ultimately Hal Jordan to be the big hero of this story, which I'm all for, and had a pretty cool Hal Jordan panel at the end with him rushing back to the league to try and save the day. So enjoyed this book very much, ready to see how they wrap up the storyline.
Including a bearded Hal Jordan, too.
Yes, a bearded Hal Jordan who has been spending some time in an alternate timeline, which would explain the beard. He's been marooned there for some time, from his perspective anyway, even though by the time he comes back to the league, I don't think it will have been as long as they perceive it to be. So, yeah, good stuff. Good stuff there from Brian Hitch. Wish he was drawing the Justice League series instead of writing it, the current Rebirth series, but we can't win them all, I guess.
Indeed not. And speaking of can't win them all, Nick and I are in a mutually shared fantasy football league that had a draft this past week. And I feel confident in saying that my team will not be winning them all this year. But that's another story, perhaps, for another time. I will let you know when I play and defeat Mr. Duke later in the season. We will meet several times.
Yes, and when he does so, it'll be the victory he's been waiting approximately 6 years to obtain.
Oh, my God. This again? Ladies and gentlemen, I'd suggest that some in our industry have a selective memory when it comes to head-to-head matchups, folks.
I'm surprised you can remember any of your fantasy football outcomes, given all the transactions you have to remember.
Oh, listen, some of us aren't content to just sit there stubbornly sit with what we thought at the beginning of the season. Some of us allow the on-field product to influence our decisions that are made later on.
And some of us clearly don't draft with a long-term strategy in mind.
That's just what some might say.
Some might say that.
Anyhow, we'll be sure to provide you updates throughout the season on how things
that
are going
none of you
on
care
that
about.
Front. Oh, you'll care. You'll care, damn it.
You'll care just as much as you cared about the Ho-Ho Loon ticker. We're replacing
exactly
the Ho-Ho Loon
right.
ticker with periodical fantasy football updates.
That's right, until we find something else to move on to.
Yes.
Well, speaking of moving on.
Just be sure not to complain about it, because if you complain too much, we'll do the ultimate nerd move and bring back our ancient Basham's ticker from college.
Oh, the Basham's ticker, complete with 30-minute explanation of what it is.
Of what it is, every time that we do it.
Yep. Anyway, speaking of moving on, we're going to move on to the rundown. That's right, the rundown, folks. This is the weekly portion of our show, for those of you who may be listening for the first time, in which case you need to go back and listen to all of our other podcasts and our friends' podcasts right here on Place to Be Nation Pop. Pop.
Or just ours.
P-O-P. Or just ours.
Yeah.
And listen to those. But if you are a first-time listener, The Rundown is our weekly segment where we watch the 2003 film The Rundown each week, starring Dwayne The Rock Johnson and Sean William Scott, and we review and analyze different aspects of the film each week.
Yeah. Christopher Walken's also, you know, in that film.
Oh, he's great. He's great. The Tooth Fairy scene, phenomenal. But... that, of course, we'll have to wait because we've decided to replace it for now with another rundown segment. This rundown is where we go through news and notes around the comic book landscape over the last week. And in this case, we've got a few items for you that are actually comic book related instead of just film and television related, which is a lot of times what we have to pick from. Starting things out, we were just talking about JLA – the return of Brian Hitch's JLA. Well, there's a new JLA coming early next year, in fact. And this JLA is going to be written by Steve Orlando of the singing duo Steve Orlando and Dawn. And Justice League
what?
Versus Suicide Squad will precede it and be a huge key cog in the Rebirth initiative for DC. You see, the Suicide Squad and the Justice League, they'll fight. Their dolls will fight, and then, you know, they'll overcome the odds and fight a mutual opponent. Well, anyhow, that's going to be kind of the end of the first phase of Rebirth and start the second phase, according to Geoff Johns himself. Nick, what does this news mean to you, and what does it mean to the public as a whole? Oh, I should also mention that Justice League versus Suicide Squad will be a mini-series that I believe is a six-issue series that is also written by Steve Orlando of the singing duo Steve Orlando and Dawn.
Anyway, it doesn't really mean a ton to me, to be honest. We knew JLA was coming. I think Steve Orlando is a natural choice given his rising profile within the company. We don't know a ton about what the premise will be or how it will differentiate from the main Justice League title. But I think it sounds, at least since it's going to be spinning out of the pages of Justice League versus Suicide Squad, as if it's not going to be something of a revisiting of the New 52 Justice League of America concept that was an alternate Justice League team that was under the control of the United States government. If you remember that one that Geoff Johns wrote for leading into Trinity War and then Forever Evil. So that should certainly be interesting. I'm looking forward to it.
Do we know who is going to be writing the miniseries for sure?
Didn't you just say Steve Orlando?
I said that because I thought that, but I'm reading the article.
See, I think it's Josh Williamson is what I had read.
I think
somewhere.
You're probably right. It would be nice if Newsarama to actually mention that in the meat of the article here, but
right. Pretty sure it's Josh Williamson. But I'm not positive.
Right. I think that sounds right. In any event, it also says it will reintroduce a supervillain that hasn't been seen for quite some time in the DC universe, an evil threat not lost to the DC universe.
Could it be the Anti-Monitor? No, wait a minute. He was just in. Yeah, that's right.
He was just in the Justice League title before Rebirth.
Starro, perhaps?
Maybe. That would be a little, perhaps, small scale. I don't know. I mean, Starro is a conqueror, after all. What about Mongol?
Mongol could be, yeah.
I don't know if he's been doing anything. Yeah, I'm trying to think of some of the potential threat level.
You talked about villains that haven't been around for a while. I mean, there's a certain, a certain lantern with a certain hue about him. Certain, maybe a little orange color, if you catch my drift.
Ooh, now I could go for that to counteract the Hall & Oates lyric. I could go for that. I was just thinking Necron, too, would be a possibility. We haven't seen him since Blackest Night.
Just seems like a weird fit for a Justice League, for a Suicide Squad.
Yeah, because that's the one thing that's kind of giving me pause. How in the world are they going to position the Suicide Squad as a legitimate threat physically to the Justice League?
I don't know. I think it's going to be more of a philosophical divide, I would imagine. The one thing that does give me some pause, and I don't think it's in this article that you and I are both looking at right now, but another article I read said that this was the first in a series of planned quarterly events, is not good, in my opinion. I vastly prefer the DC approach of being much more selective about your giant crossovers,
right.
And I do not want to see them go to the Marvel approach of beating us about the head and neck area with constant crossover events.
Agreed completely. That's been one of the beautiful things of Rebirth, is there is a continuity without the need for continual crossovers. And I'm really worried that they're going to give in to the temptation of doing the same exact crap that got them into the situation to begin with a long time ago, and this got Marvel into an obnoxious situation.
But then again, if the reports are true about Geoff Johns kind of plotting out the entire story of Rebirth in advance, then we have to have faith that these crossovers were part of the plan, don't we?
I guess, maybe, unless the company was so taken in by the 12 million copies of comics they shipped that they've decided to try to maximize profits while the getting's good.
Old Danny D. is taking over again.
You know, let's see. I'll give them faith. I mean, Rebirth has given me no reason to doubt it thus far. So I will stay with the game plan. I will fall in rank and file.
Well, although, Greg, one thing that we have to consider is if they're going to be company, if they're going to be giant crossover or a big crossover story every quarter, that means there's the possibility of Dick Grayson being killed off every quarter.
Right. Or beaten severely every quarter. Or having his identity taken away every quarter. Or otherwise used as a pawn in the game to strengthen Batman every quarter. Anyway, that's beside the point. From one company's potentially exciting yet potentially divisive news announcement to another company's ultimately disappointing to many, exciting to some announcement from the past week.
Yeah.
So for several weeks, Marvel has been teasing a new book coming up written by Cullen Bunn, drawn by some of the greatest artists in all of comics. And it was just known as the initials MU. And this caused all kinds of fan theories to pop up. My theory that I had from the get-go was Mutants United. I thought this was going to be a renewed push for the X-Men universe. Something that would involve all the mutants putting aside their petty differences, coming together as one, and uniting the mutant population. Well, silly me, it stands for Monsters Unleashed. Monsters Unleashed. A title that will be a resurrection of a title from the 70s that appears to be a horror book starring famous monsters, I'm assuming.
Some of the Marvel's more supernatural characters, like Werewolf by Night, Morbius, Blade, the Man Thing, you know, characters in that ilk, you know. So, I mean,
one can only hope it also brings back the giant-sized Man Thing.
The giant-sized Man Thing. What about the giant-sized hard-traveling Man Thing?
Hard-traveling Man Thing. One can only hope.
One can only hope. In any event, yeah, a lot of hype for this. I don't know next to anything about the horror side of the Marvel Universe. So color me underwhelmed by this, but, you know, there's got to be a comic out there for everybody, and I'm sure this will appeal to someone, even though if it seems like a bit of a waste of some A-list talent, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really have an issue with the talent they're putting on it. I'm all for – I've said this before. I think both companies, if they want to boost the sales of – the more ancillary titles, they need to put more A-list talent on them. My issue is with the hype, because they built this up as something, and they had to know that it was going to end up disappointing a lot of people. Because, you know, there is an audience for this kind of book, I think, but it would be like DC spending weeks hyping up a Jonah Hex book. You know what I mean? A big announcement
for
this new title.
That's what it's ultimately going to be.
And it's always going to be that, yeah.
You know, and we say that, and yet, from what I understand, those Hanna-Barbera books are selling very well for DC, so...
True.
There is the potential for a fringe book to cross over mainstream.
That's true.
It seems unlikely.
Harley Quinn was supposed to be a fringe book, and...
Right, and now it's the biggest freaking thing that DC has going.
Right, so, you know, hey, to each their own.
Right.
Hopefully it works out. The industry is better when both companies are firing on all cylinders. Let's hope DC can stay the course, and let's hope that Marvel can course correct a little bit, and we can get both companies kicking ass, putting out good product. On the TV side, we've got a little bit of information or items on both companies. On the DC end, Black Lightning. That's right. Black Lightning is apparently going to be getting his own television pilot. There is a series in development by the DC television overlord Greg Berlanti. He is supervising it along with Mara Brock-Akil and Salim Akil of The Game. And they are working together to create a Black Lightning television series. Now, there's no word on if this would actually be part of the CW Berlantiverse, as they call it, along with Supergirl, Arrow, The Flash, Legends of Tomorrow. No word on that, but it is in development. And Black Lightning, of course, is a character that has enjoyed bursts of popularity over the years in a lot of different titles. And Yeah, I mean, it would be some much needed diversity if he is included in the CW verse, which, you know, is presumptive on my part, but if he were to be part of the CW verse, it would add a much needed male African American lead character. So what are your thoughts on this, Nick? Is this something that gets you excited? Is this something you're skeptical about? What are your thoughts?
Let's hope it's part of the CW verse. Like you, I think it could really provide some much needed diversity to that universe and potentially complete our long hoped for solid week of DC on CW. Just go ahead and take over Friday nights or move something else to Friday nights and let this get off to a strong start on a much more ratings friendly night, because that's going to be the challenge. If they were to add a fifth CW show, I almost wonder if they might not just add it as a lead-in or follow-up to one of the existing shows, because the Friday night death slot is still very much a thing. I know that in the era of the DVR and various streaming methods to watch, it's not the ratings aren't quite as important as they used to be, but still, Friday night is tough. So you got to do what you can.
It is easier now than it used to be. Now that Friday night SmackDown has moved to Tuesdays,
right? You don't have that ratings juggernaut to take away from the potential Black Lightning show. But no, I think this is a great idea. I hope it's tied in. If only because I think we've seen that other networks don't necessarily have the same level of understanding and commitment to these shows that the CW does.
Well, as Gotham showrunner Bruno Heller reminded us last week, superheroes just don't work on television.
Superheroes don't work on television. It's the costume thing. Probably because of the costume thing. You know, TV's about real people and real faces, and Black Lightning clearly isn't a real person or doesn't have a real face. So on the Marvel side of things, we got news shortly after recording last week's show that, Squirrel Girl and the New Warriors, a team-up show between those two, is being optioned in development by ABC Studios. Not sure what network that would be on. If that would be ABC or Freeform or one of the other affiliated networks or some other network. But an odd fit, to say the least. I've never known Squirrel Girl to be a member of the New Warriors. So interesting that that's happening. But, seems like it could provide some much-needed levity in the Marvel television universe. Some levity that Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., from what I've seen anyway, does not often have and could use a little infusion of. So, interested to see where that goes, if nothing else.
Yeah, I agree that it would be a cool show to throw a new monkey wrench into the Marvel television side, because it's interesting. It's almost the reverse of the Marvel movies, where the knock has been from some that the movies are too light at times. I don't agree with that, but some have said that and don't take themselves seriously enough. On the TV side, it feels like there is a lack of that levity, a lack of that necessary humor to throw into the more serious television shows they've got, Daredevil, Jessica Jones, even Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. at this point, which I thought Agent Carter filled that role very well, but is no longer a thing. Now, the hang-up for me from nerdy comic book side is, again, I never grew up reading the New Warriors, but from what I know of them, they were not a comedy book. It was a book like, kind of like X-Men. It had comedy in it.
Or Teen Titans would be a better, I think.
Teen Titans probably a better parallel. Yeah, that's a good point. And Squirrel Girl is a complete comedic character. So it's kind of a weird fit for me. So we'll see how it pans out. But I'm all for getting new comic book properties on the screen. I think this could be a much-needed fill-in for Agent Carter, since, sadly, appears to be gone for good. And I'm looking forward to seeing what comes of it.
Absolutely. So, with all that being said, I think that about wraps up our rundown for this week.
Yep.
And that will bring a close to our, the initial portion of the show. Be sure to stick around through the break, because when we come back, it's the very first edition of Hard Travelers for Hire, and a look at one of the finest comic book movies of all time, 2008's Iron Man.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following. Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you're subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Just head to iTunes today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be podcast feed, the PWO PTBN feed, PTBN Pop, and of course, the Kevin Kelly Show feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Some really great stuff. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. Thanks for being a fan of professional wrestling. More importantly, thanks for being a fan and supporter of the Place to Be Nation.
Place to Be Nation is JT Rizzero here. In addition to the archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be podcast feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous vintage wall pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Mission Indie Possible, in our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. Relive Wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. All of this in addition to Scott Keith's Podcast of Doom, which includes discussions on questions from listeners as well as current day and old school wrestling. We also have sports covered too with the Sports Lounge, the TJ McClune Show, and NBA Team Podcast. On our brand new PTB Pop podcast feed, we offer great shows such as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both feeds on iTunes and be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows are available on PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to check out the right-hand side of the site for details on how to support the site when you shop at Amazon and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation Podcast Network. That's the PWO PTBN Podcast Network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the reaction shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We've got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
Gentlemen, this match is for the World Wrestling Federation Championship. This is an Iron Man match.
Welcome back, Place to Be Nation family, and also other people as well, to the Hard Travelers for Hire, the debut episode, an episode in which I am prepared, I've been prepared, and am prepared to deliver an experience unlike any other. Nick, wouldn't you agree?
Yes, Greg. Your preparedness and your professionalism knows no bounds.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. They used to call me old professional back in the days of yore. And speaking of yore, 2008, a year unlike any other in superheroic cinema history. 2008, the year that gave us The Dark Knight. Arguably the masterpiece of comic book storytelling on the big screen. Certainly, Warner Brothers' masterpiece. However, 2008 also gave us the kickstart of what has become arguably the most influential studio in Hollywood today, Marvel Studios. And that studio was launched with a pretty risky film called Iron Man. Now, we've mentioned this before on prior podcasts. And by the way, I'd like to remind everyone that this particular edition of ACF, this whole series, is by listener demand. We had a listener who requested us to do this series, and so we're doing it. So getting back to the point at hand, in 2008, Iron Man, or as he's known to some senior officials from West Virginia, Iron Man, was not an A-list character as he is today.
No.
I would argue that Iron Man was not a B-list character in 2008. I would argue that Iron Man was a C-plus bordering on B-level character in 2008.
I would largely agree with that. And that's something we can all get into, you know, throughout the course of the discussion of this film. But, you know, in the interest of time, Greg, why don't we go ahead and for the people following along at home, for the monkeys in the back, let's fire up the video. Got it squared up at all zeros, and we're hitting the play button in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And we're off. And there is the Paramount logo coming on the screen for the first time, because as Greg alluded to, while this was the debut offering from Marvel Studios, they did not yet have the financing to distribute their own film. So the first two films in the Marvel Cinematic Universe were released through a distribution agreement with Paramount, where Marvel financed the films and Paramount put them into theaters. So that's how that worked for this one and The Incredible Hulk, which we'll tackle in a couple months. But anyway, as Greg said, this is the kickoff to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and we are kicking off here with a character that at the time, I think people, you know, it's been over 8 years now, and it's easy to forget how risky this was at the time.
Extremely.
And all the credit in the world to Marvel for taking this risk, but it was almost a necessary risk if they were going to have their own film studio, because as we discussed a little bit on the X-Men edition of Off the Page that we did with Tim Capel, Marvel sold off the film rights to a lot of its, you know, quote-unquote A-list characters throughout the 80s and 90s.
Let's think back to the early 2000s. When you say Marvel Comics, again, put aside what you know now. When you think of Marvel Comics, who do you think of in 2005, let's say?
Oh, Spider-Man and the X-Men. Those were the two.
Yep.
You could make an argument that perhaps the Fantastic Four was the next notch down.
Hulk, I would say.
Hulk as well, but those rights for a long time resided with Universal. And Marvel actually had to work with Universal to get the rights to do an Incredible Hulk film as part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
And still haven't done a solo film since then.
That's right, because of the tricky negotiations that are involved with it. But one thing that, you know, we should probably address right here off the bat is, you know, this film is opening right now, throwing us right into the fray with essentially the origin of Tony Stark as Iron Man. The events in Afghanistan that were updated from the original comic book origin, I believe, of him being attacked in Vietnam. Is that correct, or was it Korea?
Yeah,
I can't remember.
I feel like it was probably Korea, but I could be wrong about that.
Right. But anyway, so here we are doing the updated version of the origin on screen, and it's time. I mean, we might as well go ahead and address the 500 ton elephant in the room. That is, of course, the casting of Robert Downey Jr. as Iron Man. It's easy to sit here now and say, oh, what great casting, what a brilliant move by Marvel, and it absolutely was. But
yes,
at the time, it was
as much a risk as making an Iron Man movie was.
I would agree.
Because, again, at that time, Robert Downey Jr. was not an A-list actor. He was not a B-list actor. He was firmly a C-list actor at that point in his career. He had undergone some severe personal problems, drug problems, etc., the usual Hollywood story, and fallen from grace. And actually, a couple years before this, he had had a bit of a rejuvenation in Hollywood with a movie called Kiss Bang Bang, which, if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. It is splendid. And that movie was, you know, not necessarily a financial success, but a big hit with critics, a big hit with fans, developed a cult following, and kind of got a little bit of buzz behind Robert Downey Jr.'s name. Everyone always knew how talented he was, but he was thought to be volatile. He was thought to be toxic because he wasn't an A-lister. People didn't pay to go see his movies. you know, to cast him as the lead in a movie about a character who nobody likes, that's a pretty big risk. And contrarily for Robert Downey Jr., Kiss Kiss Bang Bang had rejuvenated him in critic circles and brought him back to mind and gotten his name attached to some more artsy projects, more independent film projects, things that were going to get him back in the award discussions. And for Robert Downey Jr., signing on to play a, quite frankly, corny and outdated character like Iron Man, who was being done on the big screen for the first time, was a huge risk. It was as big a risk for him as it was for Marvel to hire him. So it's a mutually risky proposition. They're both swinging for the fences here, and Robert Downey Jr. very cleverly used that in his negotiating favor when it came time to negotiate his contract to play Tony Stark in this movie, getting a pretty nice chunk of the profits of the film, betting on himself, essentially, and the project. So just a lot of risks being taken here, and thank God they took these risks, because without them taking these risks, our current superhero film and television landscape would probably be quite different.
Right. So let's dial it back even further and go back to and talk about a little bit, you know, when this was first announced, the idea of Marvel, you know, self-financing its own Iron Man movie. When did you first hear about it, and what were your thoughts as we built toward the release of this film before even the casting of Robert Downey Jr. was announced?
I was definitely still in college, because I remember talking with you about it and our friend Greg Rossino in the Tripolitan office, which we're getting a little inside baseball here, but that was the student newspaper that Nick and I met each other through at Troy University, our college of note. And anyway, I remember us talking about it in the Trop office, putting out the newspaper, and I remember scoffing at it. Like, I thought, my goodness, they're making an Iron Man movie? I mean, I was all about the Marvel, you know, characters. I was all about the X-Men. Loved that franchise until X-Men 3 had punched me in the gut. I loved the first two Spider-Man movies. Which, when did Spider-Man 3 come out? Had that already come out?
Spider-Man 3 came out in 2006, I'm fairly... No, wait a minute. It was...
7, maybe?
Yeah, it was May of 07, I'm almost...
Yeah, so I'm pretty sure Spider-Man 3 had already come out and been a huge disappointment. So I was already just not feeling good about comic book movies at that time. And then the idea of an Iron Man movie, which I had read some Iron Man comics when I was a kid, but they were always very bland, very vanilla, very uninteresting, generic, I guess you would say, superhero comics, from the ones that I read anyway. And I was just flabbergasted. I was like, wait a minute, now they're going to do Iron Man instead of, God, almost anyone else? I mean, the only character I would think of at that time that would be more toxic to touch would be, I thought, Captain America. I was like, well, that's the one character you don't want to do because people, it's corny and all this, that, and the other. But man, Iron Man, that's a tough sell for even me as a big, you know, big fan of comic books. So I was very skeptical. What about you, Nick?
I was a little bit more open-minded than you were, but still fairly skeptical. Mainly because I was at a point where I was hungry for just about any kind of adaptation we could get. This was, you know, before the era, you know, where everything under the sun was being optioned off. We'd pretty much been treated to Batman, Superman, the X-Men, and Spider-Man, for the most
and
part.
And Fantastic Four.
With a couple Fantastic Four, a couple Ghost Riders in there that were big, you know, duds. Yeah. So I was hoping for something else that could come along and be a big-time success.
In a shocking flip of our normal positions, I think I was the cynic in this case because I'd been burned so many times by the likes of Daredevil, which I'm not as hard on as most, Ang Lee's Hulk, Ghost Rider, both Fantastic Fours, X-Men 3, Spider-Man 3.
Right.
We had been burned a lot at that point.
We had, for sure. But I want to ask you this. I mean, like, looking back on it now, it was so obvious. You know, Marvel had optioned off a lot of their properties. But did the thought ever even cross your mind at the time that, like, you know, to put two and two together and go, well, what haven't they optioned off? And then look and go, all right, well, they haven't optioned off Iron Man. They haven't optioned off Cap. They haven't optioned off Hulk. They haven't optioned off Thor. My God, they have all the pieces for the Avengers. Like, was that ever a thought in your head when this was announced?
Not when it was first announced.
No.
I remember – no, not at all. Because I remember thinking to myself, I actually thought Thor would be a more marketable movie than Iron Man would at the time. That's how my headspace was at that point. I thought, you know, Thor, you can sell it as a massive cosmic kind of deal. It's kind of, you can have kind of a dark, badass vibe to it, which people wanted in those days. I was like, you could probably sell Thor more than you could Iron Man, but it never crossed my mind that they were going to be able to build to an Avengers movie, because I assumed that this would tank. I thought that this would flop and people would reject it out of hand. I was wrong.
Right. And so let's talk about when the casting of Robert Downey Jr. was announced. I remember, and I still hold this over your head to this day, that you and I had two very different reactions to that announcement. Would you care to tell the people what those reactions were and why?
I honestly don't remember this, so I'm going to let you take over for it. I don't recall.
You were against it.
What was my reasoning?
Your reasoning was that Robert Downey Jr. just hadn't done much other than Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. He hadn't proven himself as a legitimate action star or, you know, anything of that ilk. And you thought that the only reason he was being cast was because of the personal problems and the tie to Tony Stark's alcoholism.
Right. I vaguely remember that, because I was probably being nerdy action movie guy and like, we need an action guy to play a superhero like Iron Man. Somebody that'd be believable in the suit. And I still think, by the way, that hasn't changed. I still think one of the reasons he was cast was absolutely because of his personal problems. I don't think there's any question about that. I think that they wanted deliberately to draw in an actor who had a history of alcoholism, other substance abuse as well, but certainly they wanted an actor who had that element to him, that bad boy mentality about him, that they could lend some that could give audiences who had never experienced Tony Stark before an idea of what he was like as a person, that he was damaged. He was not the pristine, perfect Christopher Reeve superhero that people might expect.
Right. But I would say that rather than viewing that as a bit of typecast or anything, I thought it just, you know, offered an opportunity for Robert Downey Jr. to bring some personal experience to the role. And also, as a result of Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, he had shown some comedic timing to possibly bring another side, a different take on Iron Man than the one. Because like you said in the comics, I mean, the character was very bland and, quite frankly, very boring. I mean, really, his defining characteristic was his alcoholism. And that's one thing we need to talk about, I think we need to bring out right now. If you were to go back and read Iron Man comics of the 80s and 90s and expect a Robert Downey Jr.-like interpretation of the character, you would be sadly, sadly disappointed. He reinvented the character completely.
Absolutely.
It's the rare instance of a movie adaptation or a movie portrayal completely changing the way the comics approach a character.
And interestingly, on set, they were more concerned while filming about the, particularly in pre-production, about the story and the action. And so it allowed the actors to improv their dialogue in a lot of cases. Jon Favreau, who directed the movie, which we'll get to in a minute, but he was, you know, he's also one of the stars of the movie. And he and Robert Downey Jr. are both really sharp comics. They have great comic timing. Robert Downey Jr. is a genius comic, as we would be reminded of later on in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. He was given free rein to pretty much say what he wanted to say, and that allowed him to reshape this character of Tony Stark, mold it from clay into what he wanted it to be. And like you mentioned, it's one of the very, very, very few examples of an actor redefining a character for the comics for years to come. Because I don't think you can ever write Tony Stark the way that he was before Robert Downey Jr. again.
Absolutely. I agree with that wholeheartedly. And right now on screen, we're getting a scene between Robert Downey Jr. as Tony Stark and Terrence Howard as Colonel James Rhodes. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, after the RDJ announcement was made, they really did a great job of filling out this cast with legitimate actors. I mean, Terrence Howard, Gwyneth Paltrow. Jeff Bridges.
Yep.
I mean, big time at the time, especially. I mean, people forget now how hot Terrence Howard's name was at the time, but like after Hustle and Flow kind of hit it big, Terrence Howard was a big critical darling for a couple of years. So I mean, this was still in the Bigby household, especially for the show Empire. But in any event, no, this was a great job. It was probably not to the level of Superman 78, but it was a Superman 78 like effort in terms of filling out a cast and bringing that era of legitimacy.
Unfortunately, we didn't have Marlon Brando coming in and saying Krypton.
No, we did not. But yeah, what were your thoughts on the rest of this cast when the announcements started to leak out?
Well, I mean, it's awfully hard to argue with. It's awfully hard to have any complaints about the casting when you've got freaking Jeff Bridges involved and you've got Gwyneth Paltrow. These are award-winning actors. You got Terrence Howard, who was red hot at the time. You can't really pick out any problems with those actors. That's you know, if you're wanting to get street cred with movie fans, that's a good way to do it, is to fill out your cast with A-listers, which is an approach that Marvel has used in other movies that needed to be buoy, such as Ant-Man later on down the line, but that's for another Hard Travelers for Hire.
Yeah, way down the line on that one. But no, yeah, so, you know, the cast was there, the production was underway, and then, you know, before the release, we started to get the first set of production stills, and the first trailers even, and I remember those being the first thing that really gave me some pause, because as you'll recall, notoriously on the Super Bowl spot that came out a few months before the movie's release, the trailers looked like the special effects were unfinished as hell.
Yeah, and you probably remember my very visceral reaction to the Super Bowl spot, the trailer they aired at the Super Bowl that year, and which was a great Super Bowl, by the way, and but it was, I remember,
enjoyed in great company, no less, right?
Let's not reminisce on that night too much, and ruin just, a good,
just
let's
remember,
not ruin a
Greg,
good memory.
Just remember, Greg, I've got arm nipples,
for God's sake, what would JR think about arm nipples? Anyway,
what would old Jim think about arm nipples?
Well, quite frankly, you know, Hodge didn't have an arm nipple. If he did, he'd squeeze it off with a Hodge job, quite frankly.
Well, I meant Jim Barnett.
Oh, my boy, arm nipples. Nah.
And that was Charles Nelson Reilly as Jim Barnett.
My boy, my boy. Nah. Anyway.
Edward G. Robinson as Jim Barnett.
if you have the arm nipple and you put it in the arm lock, and you... My God, what were we even talking about?
Arm nipples.
Oh, the Super Bowl spot.
Super Bowl
My
spot.
Visceral reaction to it. I was furious at how horrible the CGI looked. Actually, I wasn't furious. I was gloating as memory turns. I remember telling you and Greg Rossino, I was like, how could defend it? I said, defend it. I just walked in. Defend the horrible CGI.
You were actually vocally pulling against this movie at a point.
I don't think that's true. I don't think
it got to that point because Rossino and I were so optimistic about it, and you were so negative about it, and we both, each side wanted to be right, that it turned into we were actively pulling for it, and you were actively pulling against it.
I would not classify it as actively pulling against it. I would classify it as extremely skeptical and trying to keep expectations at what I thought to be a realistic level. As you know, Greg, the other Greg, tends to on occasion get a little hyperbolic in his excitement about things.
Just a little.
And I felt it was wearing off on you. And you were setting yourself up for a letdown. I couldn't know how wrong I was going to be. Indeed. Not since the release of Rocky Balboa had I been so wrong about a movie.
And been so happy to be so wrong.
Yes.
So, yeah, let's talk about that then. The release, it finally came, what was it, May of 2008, if I'm recalling
correctly.
And do you remember your first experience getting to see it?
You know, I honestly don't. It's not one of those experiences like Dark Knight or like Avengers where I remember where I was and who I was with when I saw it. But I do remember being blown away. I remember thinking when I saw it that this might be the best comic book movie that I've seen, other than, I think at that time I would have said Spider-Man 2 and X-Men 2 were competing for my top comic book movie, but I remember saying this might have matched those two great movies, because I remember everybody I was with loved it. The theater loved it. Everybody left happy. Everybody that I would talk to leaving the theater that I can recall that I know was there talked about wanting to immediately go see it again. And I ended up seeing the movie, I think, three times in theaters. I loved it that much.
I did as well. Yeah, three times. I actually went to, back in the day, and this will date us a few years, Greg, but do you remember a time when they didn't have 7 p.m. screenings on Thursdays? When you actually had to wait until later in the evening, or not? This one didn't. I have to wait till quite midnight, but they had a 10 p.m. advanced Thursday screening in Troy, and I went with Greg Rossino. We went to see it, and I remember walking in, and he was more excited than I was walking in, and I was thinking, all right, this is just gonna be pretty good. I think it's gonna be pretty good. And sitting there and watching it, and just being, like you said, blown away. I mean, the comedic timing, the action, the story, the acting by pretty much everybody in the movie. I mean, just unbelievable quality for a studio that had never produced a movie before. It was a huge shock to me. Not that it was good, but just how good it was. And we can go ahead and talk about this here, because we're not going to make it to this on, you know, to this point in the movie on this podcast. But during the weeks leading up to the release, I think we had all heard the rumors that, hey man, you know, the scuttlebutt is that Samuel L. Jackson filmed some sort of cameo for this movie. And then when it screened for critics, they actually took that post-credit scene, that mid-credit scene out. You know, that's what, you know, something the Marvel movies have become so well known for are those mid-credit tags. And this was the first one. And so when we're sitting there going to watch the movie and we're sitting there waiting to see what happens, and it actually, that scene finally plays, and Samuel L. Jackson says the words, "The Avengers Initiative." What was your reaction? Do you remember it?
Six to midnight, Nick.
It became so apparent at that point, like, that Marvel had this grand plan in place.
And what made it work, because think about that scene being tacked on to the end of any of the Fantastic Four movies.
Right.
Think of that scene being tacked on if the movie before it was a disaster and the theater was leaving and everybody was leaving the theater dejected when that scene came on. There wouldn't have been nearly the buzz. People would have left and been like, okay, whatever, cool. I mean, that's cool, I guess. It would have been the equivalent of when people saw the Sinestro scene at the end of Green Lantern. But instead, it was like the icing on the cake. It was the you've had this amazing meal, and then you're treated to this amazing dessert afterwards that just leaves you wanting more next time. And it got me so fired up and so excited about the next movie to come out. I was like, oh, how is the Incredible Hulk going to tie into this?
One thing we need to remind people of is we didn't have to wait very long for the next installment of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I think Hulk came out, what, like 5 or 6 weeks later?
Yeah, quickly.
It was a back-to-back barrage for Marvel to go ahead and get this universe kickstarted. And this was obviously an amazing first step that probably wound up being a great marketing tool for the Incredible Hulk.
Absolutely. It was a smashing idea. Absolutely smashing.
I couldn't tell if you were going for Austin Powers or broken Matt Hardy at first there.
Can it be both?
What if it could?
It should be both. By the way, you haven't filled your Senior Benjamin role for the week yet.
Ah, very good, Mr. Phillips.
Excellent.
And, but one thing I want to touch on here.
My condition was very good after the Avengers tease. I was excited to see where it was going, and could not wait to see what the other solo movies were going to look like. But yep. Carry on, sir.
So let's jump in here to the actual plot of this thing. You know, we're a good, you know, I don't know, 20 minutes in or so, and we haven't talked much about what is going on in this film. So, basic premise, Tony Stark, you know, weapons manufacturer, is taken captive in Afghanistan by this terrorist group known as the Ten Rings. So that right there shows you that Marvel is willing to reinvent some concepts from the comics. Of course, in the comics, the Ten Rings would be a reference to
a literal rings.
Yeah, rings worn by the villain known as the Mandarin, who many consider to be the most notable Iron Man villain in the comics to this point before this movie came out. I'm, you know, not having read many Iron Man comics myself, I can't say if that's true or not. It's just that seems to be the prevailing thought that he was the classic Iron Man villain for many years. So here you have the Ten Rings reimagined as not literal rings that have alien weaponry on them, but instead a terrorist organization. And so they are forcing him to build a state-of-the-art missile that they can use for nefarious purposes. And in the events of all this, when he was taken captive, he was hit by shrapnel from one of his own missiles that had been stolen by this organization, and now has shrapnel moving toward his heart, which introduces the gimmick of the electromagnet that is keeping the shrapnel out of his heart, and introduces the concept of him building his own miniaturized arc reactor that is now so iconic, the you know, the blue light that you see on kids' toys or, you know, t-shirts.
Go ahead.
Even my wife had a black t-shirt with just the arc reactor on it that glowed in the dark, actually, at one point. So
what a cool visual. Innovative visual special effect. I mean, just incredibly iconic, incredibly innovative. And I'll tell you, Nick, yeah, that just sparked a memory of mine. I remember, weirdly enough, one of the things I talked about the most leaving the theater was that arc reactor, was the suit, the way that they envision the pulse blast, the repulsor blasts from Iron Man's suit, the sound effects that it made, and that arc reactor, just how cool everything looked and sounded. The sound work in this movie is amazing.
Fantastic sound design, yes.
Really, really deserves all the credit in the world. Jon Favreau, the director, Marvel, all the people that worked on this film deserve all the credit in the world for that.
Absolutely. I could not agree more. So here we are in the cave, and we're getting this, you know, we've started to get the first inkling of what Tony has in mind, and he is, you know, building this suit, the early prototype Iron Man suit, and we're also getting a character here that, you know, I actually really enjoyed this movie, the character of Jensen, the guy who is kind of helping him in the cave and who is making reference to wanting to return to his family in this nearby village in the middle of the desert. So what do you remember about the Jensen character? I know you're not able to watch the film with me right now, and it's been a while since you've seen it, but do you remember enjoying that character?
Yeah. All of the stuff with Tony in the cave area is outstanding. I thought it was necessary to show his character journey, because in many ways, Jensen is the character that influences Tony's growth from drunken, you know, selfish, you know, completely self-absorbed playboy into what he becomes later, right? A man that can become a hero. Jensen is really kind of an inspiration for Tony in a lot of ways, and I enjoyed that dynamic. I enjoyed how he didn't just get his Iron Man suit and become a hero. You really identify with Tony Stark's journey and his changes over time. And those changes really manifest themselves as the series goes on. But I think a lot of times movies, superhero movies in particular, are less interested in showing character progression, showing the character progression as opposed to telling you about the character progression. And I think that's one thing that Iron Man shares with a movie that preceded it that may have inspired it in some loose way, which is Batman Begins.
Right.
Batman Begins is a film very much about Bruce Wayne's journey and his growth and why he becomes what he becomes, as opposed to just showing you showing him become that. Iron Man takes cues from that and does so very wisely in a way that films before it, in particular, I think of something like Daredevil, which is a movie that, again, I'm higher on than many, but Daredevil, one of the many, many flaws with it is that it didn't do a great job of showing you Matt Murdock's journey into what he becomes. He just becomes it. And I feel like that's where Iron Man really takes off, is in these Jensen scenes, because you begin to see why a guy that seemingly has it all in Tony Stark would come to realize that he did have an emptiness in him and that there was a greater purpose in life.
Absolutely. Jensen is very much – so you have – Tony's main motivation once he becomes Iron Man is to stop the damage that he feels he has caused, to cease the proliferation of his weapons that are causing, you know, chaos all over the world. And Jensen is almost the personification of that damage, all of that collateral damage he feels he has caused. And so it's an interesting thing here to have Tony faced with a person who is you know, able to show him a real-world example of the terror that has been wrought in the pursuit of profit for Tony. And, you know, one thing that I've mentioned before about Iron Man movies is that I always feel like they need to strike that perfect balance of heart, humor, and action. And this Jensen stuff really provides a lot of the heart for this movie.
Yep.
With Robert Downey Jr.'s performance, as always, you know, bringing the humor, and then of course action, you know, plays in throughout the film. So here we go. We are getting very close to the debut of the first Iron Man, the first version of the Iron Man suit. And what did you think about the way they were able to, you know, one of the classic concepts in the comics that, you know, has always been there is the idea of Tony constantly tinkering with the suit, of him bringing in different iterations at various points. So what did you think of the way they worked in from what I can recall, three different versions of the suit throughout the film?
Oh, I mean, I love it. If you're going to do Iron Man, you have to do that. You can't have – I mean, that's the only appeal that Iron Man had when I was a kid. The reason that I watched the cartoon was to see all the cool different suits that he would have. I was always a big sucker for War Machine in particular, but I remember I would be like, okay, what's Iron Man's suit going to be for underwater? What's it going to be for an aerial assault? What's it going to be for a ground strike? What's the Hulkbuster suit going to look like? And so introducing the concept of there being multiple tinkered suits and modified suits meant that later on, if they did an Iron Man 2, if they did an Iron Man 3, so on and so forth, that you would have the potential to see pretty much any of these great suits that you'd seen in the comics. So I thought it was a no-brainer to do that. I was impressed that they did do it and they took the effort to do it. And that is one of the many telltale signs that in hindsight should have told me and told us that we were in for something special with the Marvel Cinematic Universe, because they did take that time and they did go to that detail.
Yep, the attention to detail that they knew they didn't need for general audiences, but they knew they would engender goodwill from the fan community by including these sorts of things.
And another thing they did that I'm going to, you know, some people might take offense to this. I'm going to go ahead and say it, where they did well, where the competition screwed up, in my opinion, a few times. They did not care about modifying the color scheme of the costume. They did not try to dilute the colors. They didn't make it dark. They didn't give him a black costume with, you know, red trim or whatever. They went and they made it comic book accurate.
They just went with it. You know, they did the only thing they knew how to do. It was Marvel making a Marvel movie, which, you know, seems commonplace now, but really wasn't at the time.
Yep. They said if people are gonna make fun of the colors of the suit, then they're gonna do it. But they didn't, because it looked awesome when you saw it in actual. And that's another thing. While I'm thinking about it, this movie was the dividing line when we first started to think that maybe comic book costumes can work on the big screen. Because remember, before this, it was of the most comic book movies were of the Bryan Singer mold of listen, we have to modify these because people are not going to react well to them, which, as we mentioned in a previous podcast, was appropriate in 2000. But this was a movie that showed us that audiences, if you made it look cool enough and you spent enough time on it, audiences would accept comic book costumes brought to life.
Absolutely. And so here we are getting ready to kick off the first major action sequence of the film, which is Tony breaking out of his prison, you know, his cave prison, escaping his captors within the Ten Rings and making his return to civilization. So this is as good a point as any, Greg, to talk about the action in the film. There are multiple standout action sequences throughout. This one is, of course, very good, but then there are others, like I'm thinking of. Later on in the film, he actually, in his more modern version of the suit, visits Yinsen's home village, which is under siege by the Ten Rings, and throws down with the entire group in a pretty badass action scene. So what about the action stands out to you even all these years later? I know you haven't seen it in a while, but there were some pretty cool action scenes in this movie.
Right. The one that I primarily remember the most is that one with the village that you mentioned. The scenes on the village is the one that stands out most in my mind. I thought that was certainly a memorable action scene and one that really established what Iron Man can do as a character. Right. That he is a threat, that he is a legitimate superhero, that he may not have powers, but that suit is a power unto itself. I really appreciated that. I do have to say, I love this movie, and I'm not knocking this movie per se. I think one of the reasons that this movie, with the benefit of time, is not as high in my esteem as it is in others, is because I think the action is not. I'm trying to couch this because at the time it was as good as you could get for an Iron Man movie with the budget that they had, with the expectations that they had. Because the budget for this was not the, you know, it wasn't a small budget, but it was not astronomical like Batman vs. Superman levels or anything like that. But, you know, by the numbers, I would say, would classify the action scene to me. Like, about your average Hollywood blockbuster would have action scenes like this in it. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. They're not bad action sequences. I think they're indicative of the typical Marvel cinematic action scenes, which are usually kind of ho-hum and nothing to write home about, outside of some stellar exception. So I have to say, I didn't really think the action broke any new ground in this movie, personally.
I think it broke some new ground in terms of seeing this type of concept visualized, like the idea of basically the all-powerful super weapon. Going back to that scene that we mentioned with the village, I can remember specifically a couple of things that stand out as just really cool moments. Like, for example, there's a scene where the terrorists are holding some civilians at gunpoint, and you see him in the visor kind of target each one, and then like 8 darts fly out at once and just drop them. And then also there's a scene a little bit later on where he's flying and he gets hit by a missile from a tank. And so he hits the ground and fires this one tiny little missile from his shoulder that like hits the tank, and he does that badass walk away towards the camera, and you see the tank explode in the background. You just had some really, really cool moments here. Not to mention this, again, the cave escape sequence that we're seeing play out right now. I know you aren't as high on the big throwdown at the end with the Ironmonger.
No.
Although I'm going to give you the opportunity to say Ironmonger now.
We're Ironmongers, Tony.
You see, in Greg's mind, Jeff Bridges was not actually in this film. Instead, it was Brian Doyle Murray from Groundhog Day playing the role of Obadiah Stane.
We're Ironmongers, Tony. Welcome to Punxsutawney.
That sounded exactly the same. In any event, and that's a good segue, actually, because as we're seeing this cave escape play out, Tony is about to make his way back to modern society once he makes his escape. So let's talk a little bit about the plot of the movie that picks up there. Throughout the movie, it is, you know, we see Tony trying to make his re-entry to normal life and balance his new purpose with his role as CEO of Stark Industries, and we eventually find out that there is more going on at Stark Industries than we were to believe. What were your thoughts on the story of the movie once it leaves the desert?
It's kind of hard to say. Story-wise, it was good. It's also hard to say without all the hindsight of all the movies that followed this template after it. So in hindsight, I would say paint by the numbers, but it really wasn't for the time. It was setting a formula up that would be used in later movies, but you know, we're not breaking ground here in Hollywood. It's a straightforward story, but what really sets this movie apart is the characterization. The plot itself is pretty ho-hum and has been seen. I mean, honestly, the plot was seen in Batman Begins.
Right.
You know, billionaire comes home and realizes that his company is being used for nefarious purposes and that he's being kind of pushed to the side. I mean, that was done in Batman Begins, which, as we've talked about before, was a clear influence on this movie. Nothing wrong there, by the way. I don't have any issue with that.
There are a lot worse movies to take influence from.
Exactly, like Batman Forever, for instance. But you know, the plot is not original necessarily. It's not anything to write home about, but it's fine. It's serviceable, and it's necessary to let you know about this character. And the characterization is where it shines, because again, Tony Stark's character journey is what makes this movie work. You can have all the bells and whistles, all the great CGI that you want. If the character journey isn't there, the movie doesn't work. The character journey is phenomenal in this movie. And perhaps more importantly, just as importantly as the character journey, the humor, the perpetual one-liners, the caustic wit, the barbs spewed forth from Robert Downey Jr. throughout this movie. It's incredible. It absolutely separates it from any comic book movie that had come before it, certainly from any superhero movie that had come before it. And it's what gives it that little spark, what separates it from the movie that it took its inspiration from, to keep it from being called just a Batman Begins clone, because it has this comedic element that is as funny as any comedy that I've seen in recent years. And it still holds up to this day. The comedy is amazing in this movie. And part of that is Jon Favreau, who understands how to direct comedy. And a huge part of that is Robert Downey Jr., who I'm pretty sure that I'm just interchanging with Tony Stark at this point in terms of throwing the names out there. But that's because he encompasses this character so much to the point where it's hard to separate the actor from the character.
Absolutely. And so here we're getting Tony's reunion with Pepper Potts, played by Gwyneth Paltrow, whose portrayal of Pepper has been one of the few elements of the Iron Man movies that I think isn't universally beloved. What's your take on her in this film, and more broadly, how she portrays Pepper Potts in the MCU?
Well, I'll be completely honest. I have never in my entire life read a Pepper Potts comic. Never. Right. When I was reading Iron Man,
not a big fan of Rescue, huh?
I don't even know what that is.
Rescue was her short-lived armored superheroic character.
Nah, I never knew anything about it. I mean, when I was reading Iron Man when I was a young kid, Pepper Potts was nowhere to be found.
Like, sorry to interrupt you, but we must call out this momentous occasion. Right now on screen, we are getting the big screen debut of perhaps one of the biggest contributions of the MCU to all of Marvel history, and that is Agent Phil Coulson making his debut.
Oh, absolutely.
In Iron Man, would go on to play a major role in not just the MCU, but has now made his way over into the comics, is the anchor of the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. television show, just a hugely important contribution from Jon Favreau and Kevin Feige that was established here in this film. So anyway...
And before there was Cap and Tony, there was Phil and Tony, and that was the anchoring relationship of the MCU through the first Avengers movie.
Right, up until the point where, like you said, Cap and Tony got to meet for the first time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, on the topic of Gwyneth Paltrow, I have always enjoyed her chemistry with Robert Downey Jr.
Right.
In these films. However, I would say that I think, in some of the scenes that don't involve RDJ, while they are few and far between, I find her to struggle at times, and I think her delivery can sometimes come off as wooden. I don't know if that's a choice she's making to play Pepper that way for whatever reason, but I can agree that it does seem at times like she's not giving her Oscar-winning best, if that makes sense. Like, she almost perhaps feels above this sort of thing. Almost like a, almost not to the level of Natalie Portman, but in that same realm, in my
opinion. Yeah, I gotta be honest, I've never really seen that. Like, I enjoy her in these, and particularly in the first one. I really enjoy her, and in the first and the third one, I think in the second one, we're getting off topic, but in the second one, you can make the argument there because I feel like she was kind of shortchanged by the script in that one. But in this one, I kind of feel like she does a damn good job of holding her own when she's on screen with RDJ in this one. And like you said, they have really good chemistry. And I think they bring out the best in each other, which I feel like he does with.
And it adds another part of another aspect of everybody. Heart, like I was saying. It adds some more much
right.
needed
although
human,
we're,
human emotion to the.
Yeah, although I have to admit that I was concerned with the lack of earth, fire, wind, and water before the heart.
Don Cheadle as Captain Planet doesn't actually make an appearance until Iron Man 2.
That is, remind you. I forgot. That's a good point. Ted Turner's happy now. I thought she was good. You know, in fact, we haven't mentioned him yet, but if I had a complaint about anyone in this movie.
Here we go.
We're going to get into it now. If I had a complaint about anyone's performance in this movie, and I wouldn't even say it's a complaint about his performance, but rather the character he portrays, it would be, of all people, Jeff Bridges as Obadiah Stane. And, again, Obadiah Stane is not a character I was familiar with from the comics. I knew he existed in the comics. That's why I didn't outright dismiss him on name alone, because that's the name of his character in the comics. So, can't hold that against them. They're handcuffed to that name. But, I thought that the character...
In a film with a Pepper Potts, you're taking exception with Obadiah Stane.
Listen, Pepper Potts is in keeping with the great comic book tradition.
You'll deal with Lois Lane and Lana Lang and Lucy
Pepper
Lane
Potts.
And Lex Luthor and every L in the freaking Superman mythos under the sun.
That's right.
But Obadiah Stane
Obadiah Stane
too far.
Makes me laugh every time I hear it. Now, what doesn't make me laugh is the boring, uninteresting, bland nature of this character. And the fact that it feels like Jeff Bridges is pretty much just reading lines off of a teleprompter to me.
I disagree with that. You just said not 5 minutes ago that you didn't have an issue with the performance, and now you're criticizing the performance. So, first of all,
No. Well, let me. Can I clarify my?
Sure.
Go right ahead. I say that because Jeff Bridges could roll out of bed in the morning and sound cool. He's the dude. That's how it is. He could roll out of bed and read a line of dialogue, and it's going to sound great. But what annoys me is the fact that he's got a character here that has nothing for him to sink his teeth into. There is nothing to Obadiah Stane. There is no interesting caveat to him. He's
disagree.
A generic cookie-cutter villain.
Disagree with that. In the scene that we just saw play out at the arc reactor, you get a little hint of that I can't decide if it's quite a father-son dynamic or if it's an older brother, younger brother dynamic between he and Tony, but you clearly get the hint of a very affectionate relationship between those two that is well played in a scene such as this. And then later on, you get to see the menace of that character when he very calmly paralyzes the Ten Rings guy without giving it a second thought. I thought the character... Is it the most compelling Marvel, you know, villain in the world? No. And I know that's not saying a lot because the Marvel villains haven't been that great by and large, but I don't think it's nearly as bad as you make it out to be. And I wound up really liking the character, personally. And I feel like a large portion of this is as we'll get to in future installments, is probably responsible for our difference of opinion on how these Iron Man films compare to one another.
Right.
I thought he was menacing when he needed to be menacing. I thought he was charming. needed to be charming, and I liked the brief hints we got of his and Tony's familial relationship.
To me, he was a carbon copy of taking cues from Batman Begins. He was a carbon copy of Rutger Hauer's character.
The Mr. Earl Bruce Wayne relationship,
Mr. Earl,
as portrayed in Batman Begins, was borderline antagonistic from their from their reunion almost going forward. You were never given a reason, even for a second, to empathize or believe that Rutger Hauer's character of Mr. Earl had anything but the worst intentions for Bruce. Whereas here, as a result of that little prologue that you get before showing Tony before his abduction and showing Obadiah stepping up and making the speech in his honor, it shows you that there is at least some level of admiration between the two men and a sense that they were close and that the betrayal means something to Tony.
That's true. I agree that it does a better job of revealing why it means something to Tony. It does not do a better job of making the character itself more believable or more interesting. I never believed Obadiah Stane was being legitimate, not from the get-go. When Mr. Earl goes up and hugs Bruce Wayne at the beginning of Batman Begins when he gets back to Gotham, I am just as distrusting of him as I was of Obadiah Stane from the get-go. And when he paralyzes the Ten Rings guy and is completely calm about it, that telegraphs completely the fact that he has no issue making the quote-unquote hard decisions the same way that Mr. Earl makes the hard decisions to try to run Wayne Industries the way that he wants to. I think that there are some differences. Certainly, I was hyperbolic to say they're the same character, but I just don't – I never got any kind of interesting angle to this character to make him more interesting than generic evil businessman character that doesn't seem to have the kind of motivation that great villains have. Lex Luthor, you could say, okay, generic businessman. Lex Luthor's motivations are what makes him one of the best characters in comics. Obadiah Stane was like you could have cut and paste the bad guy from Ant-Man, or cut and paste Dick Jones from RoboCop, for that matter, into the Obadiah Stane character. And
right, but in the case of Ant-Man, it isn't a cut and paste from Ant-Man. That it was a cut and paste of
Iron Man to Ant-Man. Yes, absolutely. Again, it's hard for me to look at the movie without the benefit of hindsight and all the movies that have come after it. But that even at the time, as you'll recall, that was one of my only issues with the movie. I never liked the Obadiah Stane character.
I suppose we'll have to agree to disagree on that one. Of course, I'm a sucker for Jeff Bridges, so that has a lot to.
Oh, I am too. I've got nothing but respect for Jeff Bridges.
Indeed. And so we're getting ready to move on here to Tony actually getting into the act of building his suits. And this actually takes up a good little, not a long chunk, but I'd say 5 to 10 minutes of the film, and brings in some great physical humor to go along with Tony's one-liners and caustic wit, like you mentioned earlier. What were your memories of the physical humor that he gets to show off here in this portion of the film?
Oh, outstanding. And that owes to Jon Favreau and his understanding of how to direct a comedic scene, because it's hard to explain, but there are tricks of the trade of knowing how to direct a scene and knowing how to direct it for laughs and to make the laughs work at the right spot. And this is perfectly directed, perfectly edited. The music is great. The just outstanding. The sound effects, the physical humor in the movie matches the verbal humor from Robert Downey Jr. And that, I think, the bulk of that goes to Jon Favreau for being an absolute brilliant comedic director.
One thing that we haven't talked about that I want to call out right here, just because I'm noticing on screen, we're getting Tony opening the project folder, kind of creating, or starting the visualization of what will become the Mark II armor, which he actually calls it right here in the scene, which is a cool nod to the comics. And that is the complete concept shift of the Jarvis character from the comics. In the comics, Jarvis always, for lack of a better term, an Alfred clone. He was Tony Stark's butler, who was very much the Alfred to his Bruce Wayne. But here they re-envision Jarvis as an artificial intelligence and have him voiced by Paul Bettany. I know you don't know much about Iron Man comics, but were you familiar with the Jarvis concept coming into this film?
Yes, the butler who, you know, I was more familiar with Jarvis in the Ultimates, actually.
Ah, the flamboyantly gay Jarvis.
Yes.
Who wanted to bed Thor.
Yes, and who wouldn't, in fairness?
Is it Chris Hemsworth Thor?
Of course. All right. This is getting very uncomfortable. So I was familiar with the concept of Jarvis, kind of Tony Stark Alfred, essentially, right?
Yes, as I just said.
Yes. So I was familiar with that, but I much prefer the version they went with in the movie. As with all the changes they made to Iron Man in the cinematic universe, I thought this was a great change and made perfect sense, made him stand out. And what's one thing that I harp on these shows a lot? Different is good when it comes to superheroes. And that made Iron Man stand out from Batman, stand out from whoever else we had seen before, Superman, the Fantastic Four, whoever. None of them had a freaking talking suit that, you know, would have repartee with them during the course of the film. So, big fan of the Jarvis changes. What about you?
Oh, I like the Jarvis changes. It was something that never would have occurred to me to attempt. I was blown away actually by how ingenious it was to come up with that idea. I also really love in this sequence we're seeing it play out right now these cool images of Tony. Almost, he's building the suit in a virtual reality environment, that cool hologram table, if you remember, that he's able to actually put his hand in and see how things work before he tries to build them practically. So, cool stuff here, you know, all throughout these sequences with Jarvis and with Tony building the suit. So, I think we've addressed pretty much every major element of the film. You know, we talked a little bit about how it goes through the sequence of Tony building suits, and then he goes and finds out that the Ten Rings are attacking a village. Later on in the film, it's eventually revealed that Obadiah Stane is providing the Ten Rings weapons and has been dealing Stark Industry technology under the table to various groups throughout the world without telling Tony, and is making a play to position Tony as the one responsible for this, and is attempting to seize control of the Stark Industries board, because Tony, when he returned from Afghanistan, made the determination that Stark Industries wasn't going to sell weapons anymore. Stane obviously wasn't okay with that, and he winds up stealing Tony's arc reactor and building his own version of the suit, which, of course, Greg, is...
an Ironmonger.
An Ironmonger, and that sets up the big climactic Iron Man versus Ironmonger battle on top of the arc reactor.
Where he refers to himself as an Ironmonger, so.
Well, actually, I don't think he refers to himself as an Ironmonger in the climactic battle. I believe that was in their previous scene at the arc reactor that we just saw a few minutes ago. But anyway, so it builds to that big climactic battle, and of course, as is the case in all these films, our hero wins the day. Setting the stage for a climactic scene or a final scene in the movie that I gotta be honest, I didn't see coming, where you mentioned different is better, and one of the things this movie does at its close to set Iron Man apart and to make him different, he's not gonna do the secret identity thing. He publicly reveals to the world that he, Tony Stark, is Iron Man. I thought this was a brilliant move in keeping with the character that Robert Downey Jr. had established on screen. Clearly a guy who is very flamboyant, very self-confident, and it makes sense that he would, you know, be so brazen as to publicly reveal himself. What were your thoughts about that particular twist? Was it something you saw coming?
I did not see it coming until the scene started, and then I could kind of see where they were going with it. I thought it was one of the best twists ever in a superhero movie. I don't think that we've seen many, if any, superhero movies that have been that ballsy, straight from go, to just come out and say, we're not going to waste time with this secret identity crap. I'm Iron Man, and we're going to give you a publicly known superhero. Granted, the Fantastic Four movies had done publicly known superheroes, but they didn't do it in this way. They didn't go in with the idea of a superhero with a secret identity and then just smash that against the wall the way that this movie did. I thought it was bold, it took guts, and it paid off in a big way, and it made me so interested in what was going to come next. It was a great hook.
Absolutely. Could not agree more. And so we've already touched on the post-credit scene with Samuel L. Jackson and the Avengers Initiative. So let's, you know, like we said, we aren't going to make it through the whole thing here. So let's kind of wrap it up with some final thoughts. You know, it's been 8 years now. At the time when I walked out of the theater, I was blown away. And I got to be honest, this is probably, other than perhaps the Avengers, this is probably the MCU movie I've seen the most. And I think it still holds up incredibly well. I would still place it, you know, very highly in the pantheon of superhero films. One of the things we're going to do as we get a little bit deeper into this Hard Travelers for Hire series is keep a running ranking of these films as they're released. So obviously nothing to compare it to at this point because it's the first one. But suffice
right now, it's number one.
Suffice it to say, it's number one. And I, you know, if we were going to score it overall, I would say still to this day probably a 4 or 4.25 stars out of 5 movie for me.
Man, you jump around on rating scales more than anyone I've ever known. First it's a out of 10, then it's out of 5.
Well, what do you want to go with? Let's pick a
I'm fine with the 5. I'm fine with the 5-star format, but you had the 10 format on other shows.
What do you want to go with? Right? What do you want to go with, for God's sake?
I say we stick with our good buddy the Meltzer and we go with the 5-star ratings.
Now, here's the question about that, though. Will there be a 6th star available at any point, a la the Kevin Nash X Division Battle Royal
Invitational
for Bound for Glory?
You know, I don't know. That's a question that only Meltzer could answer, and the answer would come down to, does it take place in the Tokyo Dome?
Oh, that's a good point. So yeah, like I said, I actually, you know, on second thought, I'll go 4.25. I think it still just holds up incredibly well.
4.25 stars from Mr. Duke. Now, this is where we get into some weird territory for me because I love this movie. I really do. And I haven't, admittedly, I should have watched it before this podcast. I did not. I haven't seen it in quite some time. I like it every time I watch it. But it is not my favorite, even of the Iron Man movies. However, it's awesome, so I am going to go 4 stars on it. And I'm tempted to even go higher than that, but I want to leave some room to put across my preference for a later Iron Man movie. So I'm going to go 4 stars on Iron Man. Great movie. By the way, 4 stars means great, people. 3 stars is good. 4 stars is great. This is a great movie. One of the flag bearers in the comic book genre of film. And one could argue in the discussion for the most important comic book films, I would argue it is in the discussion with the original Rick Donner Superman, with the Tim Burton Batman, with Bryan Singer's X-Men, and with Batman Begins as the most important superhero films. So, yeah, that's my take on it. 4 stars, awesome movie, awesome performances, and an incredible building block for the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Absolutely. So with all that being said, that pretty much wraps up our first edition of Hard Travelers for Hire. In the coming weeks, we got more great content coming. Next week, we're going to be back with an edition of The Long Book Hunters, looking at Kevin Smith and Joe Quesada's Guardian Devil run on Daredevil from the early days of the Marvel Knights line. As well, in a couple weeks, we've also got a countdown of the top 5 Marvel video games, during which we'll be featuring special guest Marvel bigwig Ben Morse. And then coming up at the end of September, as we have told you before, we have got the 2nd biennial Place to Be Nation Pop Peter David Memorial Fantasy Comics Draft, presented by a hypothetical DC Comics Online Unlimited subscription service. After that, we have got an entire month to celebrate the return of The Walking Dead. All of October, every show in October will be Walking Dead themed. That's right, it's Walking Dead month here on the Hard Traveling Fanboys.
And we will be joined by several star-studded guests that month, so be on the lookout for that. And I want to circle back to something we mentioned earlier in the show. This entire series, Hard Travelers for Hire, was a reaction to a listener who gave us feedback and said, this is what I want to hear from you guys. And we adjusted, we called the audible, and we added it into our rotation. So I say that to say, contact us. Shoot us an email, GregP@PlaceToBeNation.com, NickD@PlaceToBeNation.com. Contact us through Twitter, @GPhillips8652, @NickDuke87, or contact us on the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page, which you should absolutely follow. We have a lot of great discussions there. Let us know if you have something that you want us to do, or you want something to change about the show. Do you want us to add something into the show, take something out of the show? Let us know, and we always are open to suggestions. You know, this is your show as much as it is ours. We want to make the kind of show that you guys want to listen to. So let us know what you think. What did you think of Hard Travelers for Hire? What do you think about the other, you know, regular series that we do? Which are your favorites? Which are your least favorites? Let us know, and we'll adjust if necessary.
Absolutely. And with all that being said, we thank you for tuning in this time, and we hope you will catch us next week. We'll catch your ass down the road.